We'll begin the thread replay from January 1993 in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is a rain replay. This is the rain report. Once upon a time, there was no ham gear imported from Japan. In the early 60s, there were two domestic manufacturers of single sideband amateur transceivers. One was Collins, the other Swan. Now, Swan later became Cubic. Cubic was replaced by Atlas, and, well, let's start at the very beginning of the Swan-Atlas story. Their founder was Herb Johnson, W6QKI, of Cardiff, California. Now, Herb became a ham in 1936, while in high school. In 1940, he was scheduled to begin attending Ohio State University. He never got there, because Dawson Bliley, W8GU, of Bliley Crystal Company, put him to work for the next 13 years, doing electrical and mechanical design work in self-excited oscillators and crystals. In 1953, Herb left Bliley and went to work for the Gonset Company in California, where he designed the G66 amateur band and broadcast band mobile receiver and matching G77 mobile amateur transmitter. 3 years later, in 1956, Herb continued his design work and consulting for Gonset from his new home in Benson, Arizona. He left Gonset in 1959, and that's where Herb Johnson, W6QKI, picks up the story.
I started working on my own projects and developed the original Swan single-band transceiver.
Now, what prompted you to begin designing your own equipment, and why ham equipment?
Well, I started in high school. I spent most of my classes in high school drawing schematics and pictorials of radios I would like to build and maybe even manufacture.
When you worked for Bliley and later on Johnson, did you have an idea in the back of your mind that you wanted to be working on your own designs for your own company?
Yeah, I guess that's sort of like what you call the American dream.
So you really wanted to have your own company from early on?
Yes.
So 1959, is that when you moved to Oceanside, California?
No, the Swan Company started over there in that little town of Benson in Arizona. In 62, we moved to Oceanside. The town was kind of small. We couldn't find enough employees.
In 62, why Oceanside?
Well, I guess it's because an old ham friend that I stopped to visit showed me where they were building a small craft harbor. And the call of the sea to a Scandinavian got me to move there.
So it had nothing to do with the business climate?
No. Fortunate, there were a lot of marine wives because Camp Pendleton is right next to Oceanside. They were willing to work not too much above minimum wage.
How many employees did you have right away?
When we left Benson, we had 25 employees, and I think it was about 20 of them that moved with us. They just packed up and headed for California just like we did. Gradually, as 63 and 64 and 5 moved along, we got more and more orders for radios, hired more and more people.
What was it about your radios that made them sell?
Well, we were at the low end of the price range. When the first single-band Swan transceiver came out, it was the only other transceiver other than the KWM-2.
The Collins.
Yeah, the Collins worked five bands, and our single-bander worked one band. It's called an SW-120 for the 20-meter, a 140 for the 40-meter.
Sure, I remember those. I became a ham in 65, and a friend of mine had an old Swan 140.
Early 62 was when we had first introduced the production model. I built the first 10 of those entirely by myself. Punched all the chassis and made the cabinets and spray painted them and silk screened the panels and the whole ball of wax. 10 radios for the first run. They were all on 20 meters except one, which was on 40. Just single sidebands. You could work CW to not AM. You could introduce carrier by throwing the carrier off balance. The 140 and 120, they were much simpler than the Collins. They were designed by the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid.
What was so complicated about the Collins that made your 140 so appealing?
Mainly that the circuitry was all simplified and things that were not necessary were removed.
Like what?
Well, you find out you can get along with one stage of IF instead of two. It's the KISS principle of taking a prototype and removing everything you don't actually have to have in there. You end up with a better product.
So your 140 was competing with the KWM2, a $1,200 radio, and yours was a $300 radio.
Yeah, 245, and then it went up to 275. It was just about one-fifth the cost of the 5-bander.
How many of the 140 and 120 series do you think you sold?
2,100.
Combined?
There were a few 75 meters.
What was that model?
That was the SW-175.
So you had the 175, 140, and 120?
Yes.
Just those three.
We never did come out with any 15 meters or 10. After moving to Oceanside and producing the single bander, the day came when Ted Henry, a Henry Radio in Los Angeles, called. We had become very close. He was selling more of our single banders than anyone else. He tipped us off that National was announcing the NCX3, their 3-bander. So he let us know that our competition was coming. They were out with it about the middle of 1963.
So we could say by 64, there was the Swan 120, 140, 175, the Collins KWM2, and the National NCX3.
The 3 was a 3-bander. Overnight, I turned the single-band Swan over into a 3-bander. That had been planned right from the beginning. It had the same size chassis and panel, same cabinet, but it had 3 bands instead of 1.
Why didn't you do that from the beginning if that's what your idea was?
Well, I guess the easiest way to put it is you have to crawl before you can walk.
Did you have a feeling that had you been able to combine all 3 bands into 1 radio in 1962, you would have?
Possibly, but there was a desire to find out if the hams would buy a single band. And it's the kind of thing where you can't take a poll and get the answer, because the answer will be nobody would buy a single bander. Ted Henry said that. He said if he had put his money on what would sell, he would have never put it on the single bander.
Now, when NCX3 came out, how well did that compete with you?
They had a lot of problems. It didn't compete very well at all. It looked very nice. It had a professional design group from Chicago who designed the appearance. Ours still looked homemade, but going to conventions, I learned from the guys that they liked it that way. They thought the National radio looked like a piece of hi-fi equipment. They really didn't care much for it.
So,
well, as soon as I found out what National was up to, I spent the whole night without going to bed figuring out how to add the other 2 bands to the single bander. And we immediately went into production.
Herb Johnson, W6QKI, founder of both the Swan and Atlas radio companies. We'll continue this retrospective in a moment. This is the Rain Report.
So then we made our first trip to a convention on the East Coast called the Sideband Dinner, which had grown from a small group to a very large number. To coincide with the IEEE, we drove a station wagon and we had 18 tri-banders with us. That was called the SW-240, and that was because we could run 240 watts input to a single TV sweep tube.
So the use of sweep tubes and finals was not something that was unique to the Japanese.
Oh, no, not at all. We started using them in 62. The Gossett Company came out with a sideband exciter that had a TV sweep tube, and I would guess they came out with that in 1961.
What tube was that?
It was a 6DQ5.
Why is a sweep tube and not the 6146 like Heath used to use?
Well, they were a lot cheaper. They were making them for TV, that's why they were cheap.
There were those who said that the sweep tube could not handle the abuse as much as a 6146.
I don't believe that's true. The only radios that Swan ever made used TV sweep tubes.
And did you add any new features to the 240 that you didn't have on the 120, 140, or 175?
Well, in the beginning, we didn't provide the sideband selection.
Meaning upper or lower?
Yes, because it basically was unnecessary. People wanted to have it anyway, so we did put out a kit where we would change it for them before we shipped, or we could send them the kit and they would add sideband selection. The Swan design would work the normally used sideband automatically, meaning lower sideband on 75 and 40, and it would automatically go to upper sideband when you went to 20, 15, or 10 when they came along. So there was no real need for a sideband selector.
Was there a technical reason, Herb, why 40 and 80 were lower and 20 and 15 were upper and that still prevails?
That's an interesting question. It's because in the beginning, the pioneers of single sideband, not the earliest pioneers, maybe they go back to the 20s. In the latter 40s, when the ham started working with single sideband, they would buy surplus equipment and they would have a VFO that they could use from surplus equipment was working 9 megahertz. And they would heterodyne that against the IF of a phasing type rig. And they had phasing networks. Maybe the IF was generated at 9 megahertz and they would have a 5 megahertz VFO. So that when they wanted to work 20 meters, they would add the 5 megahertz to the 9 and get 14. And then when they wanted to work 75, they would subtract the 5 from the 9 and come out at 4. So it made it easy to change bands. The only thing was, if they were generating the lower sideband for 75, it would come out as the upper sideband on 20. But almost everybody had a rig of that type in the beginning. And that, as far as I know, that's the only reason why 75 became a lower sideband band and 20 meters became upper sideband.
What about 160?
From there on, I think developed that if you were on the lower band, you'd be lower sideband.
And the upper bands were upper sideband.
Yeah. Drake appeared on the scene about 64, I believe. We started hearing rumors. They were building their receivers. I remember the numbers. It seemed to me they had an R1 and an R2. There were rumors about their transceiver, which would be called a TR3. That was a five-bander.
And is that when you came out with your first five-bander?
Yes, we came out with a Swan 400. That was in 64. It had a different idea that didn't sell too well. It had a separate VFO removed from the rest of the rig. I was sold on the idea. The transceiver was full of tubes in those days. The heat was causing drift problems. How nice it would be to take the VFO out of that environment and putting it in its own cabinet, which matched the transceiver. They'd sit side by side. We even provided brackets where you could join them together, but you would leave a little gap between the two so you didn't directly transmit heat from the transceiver into the VFO. The VFO had 20 switch positions for changing bands, covered only 200 kilohertz on each range. Following Collins' lead, who was doing the same thing with the KWM2, tuning just 200 kilohertz, you had to have three positions for 75, two for 40, two for 20, three for 15. If you wanted to cover all of 10, you'd have to have nine positions. So we made a 20-position VFO with a switch that had a massive detent mechanism. It took a lot of wrist power to turn it, but it was very stable. It was a solid-state VFO. The only thing in the box generating heat was the dial light. The VFO for your home station was the same height and depth as the transceiver, but just half the width. Then for mobile, we made a very tiny little VFO. You can hold it in the palm of your hand, and it worked only the phone bands, and you could put that in your car. We had a trunk mounting kit where you put the transceiver in the trunk and that little control unit up on the dash. Don Wallace was one of our big customers for that arrangement, a W6AM. Champion DXer, very well-known guy. There's a book recently written about him.
You came out with Swan 400 and the external VFO. Interesting, the external VFOs did catch on later. Why was that, do you think?
Well, that was when people wanted to have two VFOs so they could split, transmit, and receive on different frequencies.
For DX work and yeah. Contest work?
Yeah. But the sales on the 400 started off very well and then rapidly tapered off, and I learned there was just simply resistance to the separate units. So I had to take the 400 transceiver. It had a speaker in the front center of the panel so that the power supply didn't have to be fitted with a speaker and didn't have to be up on the desk or anything like that. But one evening I took the speaker out and pushed the parts around a little bit to make room and installed a VFO right in the center of the 400 transceiver. We call that one a 350.
Ah, that's when the 350 came in.
And the reason for calling it a 350 was that the other one was a 400, and we still wanted to promote the advantages of the 400, make the new transceiver look like something a little less of the two, so we gave it a lower number, 350. By chance, there were 2,100 of those sold, just the same number that we sold of the single banders.
So it didn't sell that poorly.
No, but it it wasn't enough to keep our operation going at the size it had become by then.
Would you say the 350 was your first real major success for SWAT?
That was the first time we had $1 million year.
And how many of those did you sell?
Probably in the neighborhood of 10,000.
So you sold twice more of those than you did all your other ones combined.
Yeah. It showed what people really wanted. They wanted all five bands. At that time, 160 was not a factor because it was still jammed up with Loran.
So we were talking about 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10.
Yes.
And what year are we up to here for the Swan 350? Is this around 65 now?
That came out in 65.
This has been part one of the Swan Atlas story, a retrospective. With Herb Johnson, W6QKI, of Cardiff, California, founder of both the Swan and Atlas radio companies. In part two, Herb will talk about the development of the Swan 500, Cubic's acquisition of Swan, and the story behind Atlas Radio. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago.